Thanks for joining us for Season 6 of the ACED IT Podcast. ACED IT is brought to you via the Justice Community Opioid Innovation Network, or JCOIN, with funding from the National Institute on Drug Abuse. I'm Danielle Rudes, your host, coming to you from Sam Houston State University in Texas and bringing you amazing science from today's top scholars and researchers in easy-to-understand language. The theme of Season 6 is diversity, equity, and inclusivity within the justice and health research field. I can't wait to share this season with you. Thanks for listening. Now, let's get started. In this very special season of ACED IT, I have talked a lot about substance use disorder and its treatment, but most of this discussion focused on the current state of treatment. In this episode, however, I would like to go back in time and talk about the treatment of substance use and how it evolved, especially how the disparities in treatment came about and changed over time. It is important to understand the past regarding where disparities started in order to understand the present so we can work to make things better. Stay with me. This episode might be a little bit longer than you're used to. Not excessive, but a little longer. I hope you find it worth your time. So let's go back to the early 1900s when drugs and drug policies began to be racialized. This racialization began with cocaine, which was seen as a drug used by Black men, leading to a prohibition of cocaine in the South after the Civil War. Jim Crow segregation laws in the South started to grow the roots of racialized drug policy. Danielle Jackson from the Department of Psychiatry at Rutgers, Robert Wood Johnson Medical Center, and her colleagues dug deeply into this history of racialized drug policy in their article, Disparities in Addiction Treatment, Learning from the Past to Forge an Equitable Future, published in the journal Medical Clinics in 2022. They started with the Pure Food and Drug Act of 1906, which was the first federal regulation of drugs. Surprisingly, the opioid crisis in the United States is nothing new. In fact, the first opioid crisis occurred between 1865 and 1913. The first opioid crisis emerged as a result of the unregulated use of opium in many pharmaceutical companies' products and the invention of the hypodermic syringe. Over time, medical technologies were advancing just like they are today. This advancement led to the formulation and availability of drugs like morphine salts and heroin. At this point in history, the late 1800s, addiction was seen as a medical condition that needed treatment. Now, back to the Act of 1906. Its purpose was to eliminate opioids and cocaine from medication, required medications to be labeled, and wanted to restrict physicians from prescribing medications containing opium. Pretty quickly after this, in 1909, smoking opium was banned entirely. This ban, though, was heavily racialized. It included propaganda targeting Chinese immigrants. The next piece of law put into place was the Harrison Narcotics Act of 1914. This act created the taxation and regulation of the import of opium and coca derivatives. This, in turn, led to the criminalization of substance use. This was where the real turn happened in how opioid use disorders were viewed. The Harrison Act made using opium not a medical condition anymore. Instead, it made it illegal for physicians to treat it. This is where opium use started to be viewed as a moral failure, making people with substance use disorder seen as menaces to society. The only treatment or cure that was discussed now was abstinence. With this in mind, referred to by the authors as the temperance movement, new drug policies moved across the United States through the 1900s. Many of these policies were motivated by racial politics or national anxieties over immigration. Policies related to cannabis was one of those motivated by anxieties surrounding immigration, and it targeted immigrants from Mexico. By the 1930s, after alcohol prohibition ended, the anti-Mexican propaganda had gained national attention. This was when Henry Anslinger, who was the first commissioner of the new Federal Bureau of Narcotics, passed the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937. This act created heavy taxes on the sale of cannabis, and it created the negative connotation between cannabis and people from Mexico and South America when it renamed cannabis marijuana. Illicit drug use in the media was heavily playing to white American fear. The media portrayed reefer madness among Mexican people and showed the unsuspecting white female victims lured into a life of debauchery. There was a period of time following the 1930s when there was not really a ton of interest in the legislation of drugs. Some drugs, like cannabis and psychedelics, became part of the anti-war hippie counterculture. Shortly after this, though, in 1971, Richard Nixon declared that public enemy number one was drug abuse. As the authors point out, though, there was not an increase in the number of people using drugs between 1930 and 1970. During this time, racial politics took hold, and this type of thinking forced a new direction where drug use was considered anti-American and a way to push down Black community leaders and activists in inner cities. The 1970 Comprehensive Drug Abuse and Prevention Act, also dubbed CSA, came about making the control of certain plants, drugs, and chemical substances a matter of federal jurisdiction. This act also prohibited the manufacture, sale, and possession of controlled substances. It also made five different classes of controlled substances, depending on how dangerous they were, the potential for their misuse and addiction, as well as the legitimacy of medical use. This is where the Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA, and the Racketeering-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations, RICO Act, came into play. The pieces of legislation that the act created made people who used substances even more stigmatized and led them to be viewed as addicts and criminals, moving even further away from the original medical issues substance use was seen as. During the 1970s, several states followed in the footsteps of the national legislation regarding drugs and drug use. One of these states was New York. The Rockefeller laws led to a wave of mass incarceration of Black and Hispanic men. There were some medical treatment centers at this time that used medications like methadone, but Black individuals were disproportionately being incarcerated and not giving access to that treatment. The Rockefeller laws' impact doesn't stop there, though. This was the first set of laws to make mandatory minimum sentencing that was based only on the amount of drugs possessed. In the 1980s, the state and national levels were enacting what's now called tough-on-crime drug policies, like the Comprehensive Crime Control Act and the Anti-Drug Abuse Act, just to name a few. These new policies were following in the footsteps of New York and giving mandatory minimum sentences for drug crimes. These mandatory minimums were heavily racialized too. Crystallized crack cocaine was given a 100 times longer sentence than powder cocaine. How is this racialized, you might ask? Well, to start, pharmacologically, cocaine and crack are the same substance. But also, at this time, the media was portraying crack cocaine as a problem only for inner-city Black communities and making it seem as though people addicted to crack were more violent than people who used powder cocaine. This era in time is often referred to as the War on Drugs. The War on Drugs led to a 6 to 8 times increase in the incarceration of people, typically young Black men, for nonviolent drug use. This history of drug policy in the United States that I just reviewed gives us the foundation for understanding how many historically marginalized communities have been systematically criminalized for drug use and have been unable to access treatment for addiction. Now let's move on to talking about structural racism and the disparities in substance use challenges that it causes. For those who need a little refresher, structural racism is the system in which public policies, institutional practices, cultural representations, and other norms work in various ways to perpetuate racial group inequality. Structural racism can be seen in every piece of substance use treatment, from policy to healthcare delivery and even research. The authors continue their article by going through how structural racism in healthcare delivery with medication for opioid use disorder, or MOUD, and federal regulations create inequalities in the substance use treatment of historically marginalized communities. First, let's talk about MOUD. There are three FDA-approved treatments for OUD. Two of these are methadone and buprenorphine. These are shown to decrease overdose and mortality risk. These medications have extremely restricted access, though. Methadone is required to be administered only in a federally qualified opioid treatment program, or what's called an OTP. Upper-class white individuals were upset by the geographic distribution of OTPs because they were afraid of being so close to individuals with OUD who used heroin, like we don't want them in our neighborhoods. In turn, OTPs are now concentrated in neighborhoods with a higher concentration of people who identify as Black or have Hispanic origins. As I mentioned, methadone has highly restricted access. The majority of regulations placed on methadone use were not consistent with the best practice recommendations, though. COVID-19 has helped out a bit with this, as the pandemic created exemptions to some of those regulations. The second MOUD medication, buprenorphine, became available in 2000. The accessibility of it was heavily marketed to clinicians who practiced in rural and suburban white communities. It was said to be even better suited as a treatment for suburban, white-collar people with OUD. This racialization of the medications available led to white individuals having higher utilization of buprenorphine because the medication targeted to them was less restricted. Current studies have shown that the accessibility of buprenorphine and methadone at the census tract level, like communities and neighborhoods, show significant association with racial segregation. Based on what we talked about, it is not surprising that buprenorphine is now more available disproportionately in areas with higher concentrations of white people, and methadone is more available in areas with higher concentrations of Black and Hispanic folks. The impact structural racism has on disparities in substance use treatment is also seen in the carceral or correction system. A disproportionate rate of Black and Hispanic people are behind bars because of substance use. Related to this, court officers prefer naltrexone over the other two medications as a treatment for opioid use disorder, even though it is the only one that does not decrease mortality risk. These disparities due to structural racism need to be addressed. Doing so will force healthcare policies and accountability at both the social and individual levels to make sure that people with substance use disorder get the best treatment possible. There are a few solutions that have already been proposed that may be helpful for you to think about. These include lifting the regulatory hurdles, limiting clinicians who prescribe buprenorphine, increasing addiction education exposure in all health professions, and increasing educational partnerships with clinicians who do not treat substance use disorder to improve the attitudes regarding how we care for people with substance use disorders. The authors continue by discussing something that they call structural competency. In case you haven't heard of this before, it is a tool for health professionals to recognize and respond to health and illness as the downstream effects of broader social, political, and economic structures. What it basically means is that something else happened in the social landscape that leads us to this problem, the problem of substance use disorder. Structural competency gives way for professionals to address the downstream effects of inequities in addiction because of structural racism. These downstream effects are also referred to as the social determinants of health, SDOH. You heard that term before in several other episodes in this season. Structural competency makes clinicians move past just acknowledging SDOH and move to intervening on the social conditions that impact healthcare inequity. The structural competency framework has five components to help change our understanding of patients and related treatment planning. These five components are 1, recognition of the structures that help shape clinical interactions. 2, recognitions of the influence of these structures on clinical interactions and health outcomes. 3, responding to structures from within the clinical setting. 4, learning to respond outside of the clinical setting. And 5, developing structural humility. By following these five components, we can address addiction treatment disparities, or at least we can begin to do so. Don't worry, we don't expect you to know how to do this, and neither do the authors. That's why they include a few examples of interventions that follow this framework. First, you can incorporate a substance use treatment specialist into primary care clinics and federally qualified health clinics. Second, you can consider working toward the expansion of mobile health units that provide harm reduction and health services to people in need without as many geographic barriers. Why? Because it comes to you. Third, I'll give you one last intervention they provided. You can work to create robust hospital-based substance use consultation teams that initiate and facilitate substance use treatment in the hospital setting. These interventions are not enough to totally end disparities, though. We have to use a multifaceted approach. There needs to be a substance use treatment workforce that is representative of the population that is most adversely affected by substance use disorders. There are two programs in research and education that are doing this right now. Learning for Early Careers in Addiction and Diversity, or LEAD, is one, and Recognizing and Eliminating Disparities in Addiction Through Culturally Informed Healthcare, REACH, is another. I urge you to look these up and learn as much as you can about their valuable work. Systemic racism in substance use and its treatment is nothing new. It has been going on since the 1800s, and it's about darn time that it came to an end. I will leave you with this. To overcome existing disparities, there needs to be a concerted and deliberate approach that involves intentionally recruiting a diverse substance use treatment workforce who can foster a close collaboration between policymakers, healthcare systems, and clinicians. I know you're thinking, how can I, just one person, change a structurally racist system that has literally been in place for over 200 years? I hear you, but I ask you this. How can you not want to? How can you not work to? Change is hard, but not changing is literally killing us. Thanks for tuning in to ASTIT, where we translate science into sense. You can find ASTIT anywhere you listen to podcasts and check out our other offerings on JTech. That's www.jcoinctc.org/JTech. That's J-T-E-C. We consider it our mission to help everyone learn. On JTech, you'll find e-learning courses, webinars, and other trainings, all geared to help you learn about justice and health research and research methods quickly and easily. Special shout out here to George Mason University, home of the Coordination and Translation Center for JCoin, Sam Houston State University, and National Institute on Drug Abuse and the National Institute of Health. Also, if you'd like us to break down some research that you've read or produced in a future episode of the podcast, send it to me at droods, R-U-D-E-S, @shsu.edu. See you next time on ASTIT.